Paul McCracken has advised United States presidents and been involved in some of the most significant economic policy decisions in the last half century. From his childhood in rural Iowa, through his early experiences in the Great Depression, to the halls of political power, McCracken has understood the importance of these policies and the lives that they affect. He went to a simple one-room schoolhouse as a child. Coming of age during the Great Depression, he watched as his father shared the fruits of his labor with neighbors less fortunate.
We didn't have to read statistics on GNP, which of course did not exist. And the problems were all around us.
McCracken was fortunate in being able to attend William Penn College in Oskaloosa, Iowa, and then took a position teaching English at Berea College.
I graduated in 1937. Into the ranks of the unemployed, as everybody did. And in the middle of the summer, out of the blue, came a letter from Berea College in Kentucky offering me a job teaching. It wasn't an inquiry, it was an offer. And as I told somebody, if it had been an offer to teach Swahili, I would have accepted. It's the only offer I had.
He saved his teaching money and 3 years later enrolled at Harvard University for graduate work in economics.
I remember moving into my room at Perkins Hall on Oxford Street, and I thought, what is a boy from the Iowa cornfields doing in a place like this?
Overcoming any initial apprehensions, McCracken went on to earn both his MA and PhD degrees at Harvard. He worked as an economist in the United States Department of Commerce. In 1948, he became a faculty member of the School of Business Administration at the University of Michigan. Yet, it is in the world of government rather than academics that McCracken's economic thinking has probably held the greatest influence. From 1956 through 1959, he served as a member of the President's Economic Council for President Eisenhower. He returned to the council in 1969 to serve as chairman during the Nixon administration. He also served as a member of President Reagan's Economic Policy Advisory Board. Throughout his work in government, McCracken's advice and thinking were guided by his belief in individual liberty and the role that the free market plays in creating a robust economy. In addition to his political and academic efforts, Paul McCracken has had a long and rewarding involvement with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., where he has served as an author, board member, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, and interim president. In the mid-1970s, McCracken's economic views began reaching an even wider audience when he began writing a regular column for the Wall Street Journal. Through his work in academia, government, and the popular press, Paul McCracken has had a long-term and steadfast influence on modern economic thought and policy. Liberty Fund welcomes you to a conversation with Paul McCracken.
Paul, you are a quintessential American success story. You grew up on a dairy farm in rural Iowa, came of age during the Depression, were schooled in a one-room schoolhouse, and went on in later years to become one of the most influential economists of the century, an advisor to numerous presidents, deeply involved in many of the most important economic policy decisions of the past half century. What people were most influential in your early years?
I would mention three or four. Alvin Hansen at Harvard, Schumpeter, who was chairman of my thesis committee, Gottfried Habeler, who had read everything remembered everything, was just the epitome of a gentleman. Of course, he was in AEI for a long time. I would say those would be the ones I would think of.
You jumped from the your small high school in Iowa to the great economists of Harvard. When was it that economics first began to interest you?
I think probably in college, but probably more because two of my uncles got doctor's degrees in economics at Madison. And I began to think of that as possibly the way I wanted to go. And I might add that I did have this little college, which at that time was gasping. It was a Great Depression. But we had some good teachers there, too.
When you became interested in economics, was it a subject like trigonometry that just seemed to be intellectually interesting and challenging, or were there practical experiences, the Depression years in particular, that led you to think that this was a calling, something that could, where you could make a practical difference?
I think many in my generation, or for many in my generation, the latter was very significant. We had people in the little town we knew didn't have food, and our friends. And a friend who got his master's degree finally at Michigan told me, did you know that your father came, his father, by the way, was minister of the little rural church where we went. He said, your father came up once with a ham and some potatoes. We didn't have any food in the house. So we didn't have to read statistics on GNP, which of course did not exist. And the problems were all around us.
Did you have any developing political views at the time you arrived at Harvard? Did you consider yourself a Republican or a Democrat? Were you interested in politics?
Not very much. Obviously, the area where I grew up was predominantly Republican. I remember maybe it was 1928, I believe Al Smith received two votes, and there was a good deal of discussion about who these renegades were.
You mentioned three of your professors, Schumpeter, Hansen, and Habauer. I'd like to ask you a little bit about them as teachers, about the ideas that made the strongest impression on you. Of course, Schumpeter is very famous.
At that time, Hansen was far better known than Schumpeter. Hansen was widely considered to be the American professor who really first understood what Keynes was driving at in his general theory. And he was a superb pedagogue. His capability to take fairly complex things and explain them, elucidate them, was enormous.
What were the major ideas in his courses and lectures that impressed you at the time?
He had developed a structure or framework to explain why an economic system such as ours might have moved down so far and then kind of just stayed there. And for the first time, this very puzzling thing, why didn't the economy bounce back up the way it usually had? It began to be, at least there began to be an explanation for it.
You mentioned Habauer, one of the great students of the international economy and one of the great advocates of free trade among nations. Was free trade a issue at Harvard in the 40s? Did people talk about Smoot-Hawley, the Smoot-Hawley yeah. tariff, the way we do in the 90s, looking back on that period?
A little. By the way, Smoot-Hawley was a lousy idea, but it wasn't as overwhelmingly nefarious in terms of its effect on the economy as we like to believe. But it was mentioned. But the Keynesian, the structure which Keynes developed in that great book, which came out in 1936, I believe it was, came to be the explanation. I might add that you have to go back and almost study developments year by year from 29 on down to see what really happened. And that's probably another topic. But I think the critical year, it started out very much as an ordinary routine recession. The central bank, the Federal Reserve, did what central banks should do. They hit the inflationary boom in the stock market, hit it hard, but they backed away very fast. And in 1930, in a series of moves, reduced the discount rate, which was the major instrument at that time. And if it looked as if you look at the data carefully, it looked as if around the end of 1930 and early 31, it was starting to come back. Then, of course, England went off gold. France had already gone off gold. Now, by this time, I was old enough to be reading the paper, and I remember there was some calamity which was about to hit us, going off the gold standard. I didn't know what that meant, but I do. I can recall that. And there is where Hoover, in some ways a more modern man than most presidents, made a critical mistake. And in 1931, the Fed increased the discount rate 2 full percentage points to stay on gold. Well, of course, we didn't anyway. But it gave us 2 more years and the Great Depression.
When you were at Harvard, there were these great men who had grand theories, sweeping explanations of the dramatic events that had taken place in the past 15 years. I wonder if the idea of individual liberty, the role of the entrepreneur in the economy, whether freedom, which to many people in later generations seems to be the most important fact about American society and about the American economy, was a matter of any particular interest or debate?
My short answer is no. by that I mean we weren't the major problem didn't seem to be freedom. It seemed to be how do we create jobs and get the economy going. But at that point, then we didn't see what I think the profession now sees, and I'm sure you could find it in many books in this library, the critical role of freedom in creating the dynamics within the economy that will help to keep an economy going. But the whole evolution of this really received an enormous push with the publication of The Road to Serfdom.
Schumpeter is associated with the view that socialism could be a wave of the future that would be supported by business interests and government planners alike. Was that a idea that was talked about? Did it seem before Hayek that increasing state control of one sort or another was inevitable, was the wave of the future. Was that an uncontroversial idea before Hayek?
I suppose it was a somewhat controversial, but I think once again my short answer is no. The idea, we've moved into an era when, thinking back to the decade of high unemployment, government would have to do a lot more managing of things. So that wasn't all that controversial.
You mentioned that Professor Hansen was the great dominant figure at Harvard and to some extent in economics in general. Today he is forgotten, very, very little known. And yet Schumpeter, who was not anywhere near as eminent as Hansen was, 50 years after his death, is one of the most famous economists of the century. I think in part for his work on economic development, but most for his great final work, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. Why do you think it is that Schumpeter has come to play such an important role decades after his death?
I think Hansen is forgotten about because the era to which he addressed himself is now ancient history. Schumpeter in Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, which, by the way, he said he wrote for the layman, not scholars. Schumpeter was talking about more fundamental movements in the evolution of a society and an economy. And it seems to be, if anything, probably more relevant today than it was when he wrote it. So it speaks to the contemporary era because his basic concept of each era sort of growing out of the prior era.
Yes.
That's an important, in other words, that application of the Hegelian process to economics, that's an insight that's very important. The trouble is, Schumpeter being the logical German Teutonic scholar had to try to carry it to the logical conclusion.
You mentioned Hayek in 1943. In that year, at least I guess it was at the end of 1942, you'd gotten your master's at Harvard, and you went to work for the government. You went to work at the Commerce Department. And I understand that some of the work that you did then was on the whole question of the coming peace. And I recall in reading back in that era that there were many people in Washington, especially in the Congress, that feared that the bad times would return and were beginning to advocate a retention of wartime controls, mobilization programs, and so forth. And yet it did not happen.
It's certainly understandable that people feared that with the war ending, we would go back and pick up where we left off, high unemployment and so forth. In the Department of Commerce, there was a little unit at that time called the National Economics Unit for some reason. And I got a job there. And our objective was to address the question, and it eventuated into a pamphlet or a study, the title of which was Markets After the War. And I did the most of the quantitative work incident to that. We were showing that given where the economy was by then, what the markets might be for automobiles, for example. I do recall our estimating that the demand would exceed the capability of the industry. This was sent to the statistician at Chrysler, who wrote back that this was absolute nonsense. Well, we were right, he was wrong. I do consider that one of the, in many ways, one of the most significant pieces of work that I did. The author, whose name appeared on the study, was of course the head of the unit, which is the way it usually was. But we almost were alone.
This strikes me as an important turning point. In this year, Hayek's book is published. The many, many discussions about the importance of maintaining nationwide production controls, price controls in peacetime sort of melted away. And in fact, several years later, when the war was over, the economy was demobilized and decontrolled very, very quickly.
Very quickly, and with surprisingly low unemployment.
Right, right. Was it that the arguments such as you put together won the day? Was there resistance, not from Chrysler, but from people that wanted to maintain government control?
I don't think it was that our arguments won the day. I think it was that, if I may say so, we perceived what the nature of this reconversion back would be, frankly, better than they did at the Federal Reserve or the Labor Department, which are two that that are often were often mentioned.
And when you went to Michigan, late 40s, early 50s,
48,
you were teaching in what fields?
I was teaching in the School of Business.
Yes.
But they had a little economics operation, which is a little larger now. And I was offered courses in statistics to teach, and which I could have taught then, or this course in business conditions. And it occurred to me, that's a pretty good title. I think I'll take that. So that's what I taught.
In your early years at Michigan, you continued to be interested in government policy. And you met several individuals whose work, the work that you did with them, led you within a couple of years to be a member of President Eisenhower's Council of Economic Advisors. One of them I know was my predecessor and your predecessor, Bill Baruti, who was head of the American Enterprise Institute. It had been formed back in the 40s to advocate rapid demobilization in 1943. Baruti was there in the early 50s. Did you know any of the other people associated with AEI in those years? I know Milton Friedman was one of the advisors. Henry Hazlitt, the economics journalist who wrote Economics in One Lesson, was affiliated with Baruti.
Gottfried Habeler
wrote some of the first pieces for them on advocating flexible exchange rates.
So much of the literature advocating no government and freedom and that sort of thing was really very thin. One thing that Bill did was to get people who wouldn't tolerate a thin piece of work. And toward the end of the decade of the 50s, or maybe more into the 60s. As I've often mentioned, a professor, colleague maybe at some other university, would ask me, "Did I see that you have some connection with AEI?" More or less with the tone of, "Did I see you enter a bordello last night?" And then the tone shifted, and it was more, "I know you have a little association with AEI, do they have any fellowships for professors? So, and it seemed to happen kind of suddenly, as these things go. Finally, it was respectable.
You became a member of the Council of Economic Advisors in 1956, I'm guessing, I think.
Right at the end of the year.
Right. How did that happen?
I think for anyone who goes to Washington, the one piece of information they do not have is, how did you get known down there?
What were the major issues that you dealt with in the Eisenhower administration? What did you think of Ike, and what controversies were you involved in?
When he talked to me about joining, he was very cordial, very pleasant. I remember he said at the end, people around here know I don't like long memoranda. But then he grinned and said, but I'm not sure economists can do that. But he also said that, and this, I guess other presidents do this, say this too, that now from the Council of Economic Advisors, we want the straight dope. For God's sakes, we don't want to start out kidding ourselves. And I've always remembered that.
On those memos that you wrote to Eisenhower, I understand that you were a very strong advocate of cutting taxes. Were you an early supply-sider, or was this an old-style fiscal stimulus idea? Where did that come from?
I think it was a residue from old-style fiscal policy. And I decided the president was right and I was wrong, because the recession began around, I think, September 57. Business activity was starting to rise about February of 58. Anybody who's had anything to do with the Congress knows it can't act that soon anyway.
Right.
So, as I understand it, three men met periodically, Eisenhower, Johnson, and Rayburn, usually agreed, and apparently Johnson said, well, I don't want a tax cut either, and if you don't send a message up to the Congress, there won't be one emerging from the Congress. And so there would be stirring speeches on the Hill about the need to cut taxes, but no bill.
Nothing happened. You went back to Michigan. What did you feel that you had learned during those years? How had your thoughts about policy
in Washington
evolved? Yes.
That the old fiscal policy wouldn't work. And by the way, I do recall calling on the man who was the head of the General Services Administration, you know, the housekeeping thing, as we were going into that 57, 58, and asked him, don't you have some projects really all planned out so that, you know, if we could get the money, they'd get going? I've never forgotten. Oh, he said he was delighted to hear that. He said, now look at this cabinet here, and it was full of something or other. And I said, well, how soon could you get going on one of those? Oh, we could get going probably in a year. Well, that wasn't what we talked about at Harvard. So that was another nail in fiscal policy's coffin from my point of view.
Did your courses change?
Quite a bit.
Were you still teaching business conditions, or did you teach more about policy?
But what you would say about policy was very different than what I had said earlier. If I had to identify one change, it was that I came back from Washington with a conviction, you can't talk about the economy as if only domestic things mattered. So I started introducing a good deal more foreign economic developments and policy.
You were teaching at Michigan. You were involved in a number of studies and commissions. And you did some work, I believe, for President Kennedy and later for President Johnson. Mm. Would you relate that a little bit?
For Kennedy, that was in December before Kennedy was inaugurated. The Undersecretary for Monetary Affairs was going to be Bob Rosa. Bob and I had become acquainted at Harvard. And he asked the outgoing chairman or president of the New York Bank, one of Truman's advisors, and I, to write a memorandum to Kennedy on the emerging problem of reconciling domestic and international economic policy. And so we did. We wrote a memo, I think a pretty good one. I don't think it had much impact.
What was the point? What was the analysis or recommendation?
Basic point was to make some suggestions, but I think the basic point was we have to take the international dimension of economic policy anymore into account.
Well, trade and finance was becoming more global, even in those days. But what would be an example of how domestic policy would have to take into account?
For example, Kennedy found himself confronting the dilemma case, which is the economy was a little weak. Remember, toward the end, in that final year with Eisenhower, it was sagging. Well, that would suggest, among other things, an easy, expansionist monetary policy. But the dollar was kind of weak, and that was causing us problems externally. That suggested we ought to tighten up the dilemma case. Looked at one way, you go that way, and looked at in another way, the opposite. And we made some specific suggestions. For example, our currency was mostly, except for dollar bills, was mostly Federal Reserve Bank notes, against which the Fed had to maintain a 40% gold reserve requirement. And that reserve ratio was going down persistently. I sometimes use this in the classroom as an illustration of political economy. And we suggested, well, you ought to send a message to the Senate Banking Committee and get that requirement eliminated. And I remember Kennedy's, yeah, I see the problem there. Now let's see, who is chairman of that committee? Oh my God, old Harry Byrd. If I requested that, I can see this yet. I can see old Harry Byrd going right through the Capitol Dome. And I think he made the right decision. But I think we did the right thing to call it to his attention.
I'd like to talk about your years in the Nixon administration. How was Nixon as a boss, an intellectual companion?
Nixon was very able. He didn't find economics very interesting. After his tour with Kennedy, he decided it was important. He, in some ways, he was, of course, a strange man. How he got trapped, that all happened after I left.
But he got trapped in another way before you left, at least according to, looking contemporary perspective. in launching this national program of wage and price controls.
He did.
At the end of August 1971. August 71.
Mid-August.
The Camp David meeting. There were some good things that were done at the time. It tends to be overshadowed in popular lore by the wage and price program. And I'm very interested in how the arguments emerged. And I'm sure that many of the economists were opposed to this, and yet it's something that he did.
I think it's a case of fundamentally that he got trapped between something which in the purely political direction was inevitable, maybe unavoidable, even though you knew it would come to disaster. And the story really begins with, I believe it was an appropriations bill for defense, where the Democratic Congress attached a provision giving the president standby authority to impose wage and price control. Now, I think in retrospect, that was the place where Nixon should have drawn the line. But that's a political judgment, and I can't claim that I saw it all. We were pursuing fairly stringent monetary policy. The gold supply, gold stock, was declining. The UK indicated that they would like to withdraw 3 to 4 billion of gold. And,
That was a lot of money in those days.
That was a lot of money in those days. And if that had, if we had exceeded, well, the queue line in front of the gold window would be all the rest of the countries. And I can remember Paul Volcker, who was Undersecretary for Monetary Affairs. I can remember his coming over to my office once, along in there. He said, well, we can get through this weekend, and probably we can get through next weekend without closing the gold window. But that's about what we're talking about. Now, given the fact that the president had the authority to deal with inflation, as people would put it, including the press, if he had, in effect, closed the gold window, I'm sure he would have been lambasted. Well, why didn't you deal with inflation when you put it all together? So there are times in the political arena the political leader has no alternative, I think, but to do what ought not to be done.
It was certainly highly popular at the time. Across the political spectrum, yep. Business, if anything, business was more enthusiastic than labor.
And I can remember being at the business council meeting a little later on when it wasn't working out quite that well, being lambasted, and George Shultz was the speaker at that time. And you know George, in a very quiet way, he said, no one probably was more influential in driving this country into wage and price control than this audience right here. And one or two protested, and one of them got up, somebody else got up and said, I just want to say that's absolutely right. You guys were all on the other side. So it wasn't a case of where business didn't want it. At the time, they wanted it. I might add, if you ever had any uncertainty about the complexity of a market economy, be responsible for wage and price control.
You learn a lot, more than you ever
Can't
wanted.
Can't be done.
Yeah. Paul, the 1970s did not go well for the American economy or the world economy on many of the parameters that you have been concerned with over many years. And you were not in the government during those years, but you played a prominent role in policy debate and in many respects in this continuing progression of views about the appropriate role of the state in the economy. I'd like to ask you about some of those endeavors of yours during that year, during that decade, beginning with this quite important, I believe, committee for the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, that you headed up in 1976 and 1977, which I think, looking back, was responsible for expressing a new view about appropriate government economic policy. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. if I had to identify two things I have been involved in that I think made a little difference. One of them was markets. was markets after the war, which of course was done during the war. But the other would be this effort with the OECD. We had this this obsessive determination to believe that there was a way to persuade people not to increase prices, even though the milieu made it clear that that was a thing that should be done. And when I showed up in my office with Mr. Nixon, I turned to the pertinent chapter in the economic report of the president, which of course had come out before Nixon became president. So this was Johnson. And he said that, well, now there is a little problem of inflation. But on the other hand, we must be able to deal with this without any adverse impact on employment or unemployment. Now, he didn't know how to do that, and nobody else did. And so it was kidding people into thinking there was a painless way to do it. And when I think we did the right thing, our little council, when we testified a week or two after taking over, we said the guidelines are dead. We didn't kill them. They were dead when we got here.
And, excuse me, the guidelines?
Yeah, the wage guidelines, wage price guidelines. And but European countries were trying all kinds of ways other than facing frontally. If you don't like inflation, you got to face it. And so finally, Emil van Lennep, who was a Dutchman, head of the OECD, appointed this committee. It was a pretty good committee. Robin Matthews of UK, a professor from Japan, Herbert Giersch, and so forth and so on. They were pretty hard-nosed people. And in essence, the thrust of it was, if you want to limit inflation, you just have to confront it frontally. And then I remember the meeting in Paris with foreign ministers, I guess, or finance ministers, and I had to make the report. And I think it was almost a case, well, when somebody said it, well, it's obvious. And there was almost a change in thinking toward a more realistic point of view. Well, that's a long speech, but...
I think the word I recall is non-accommodation.
Non-accommodation, that if you want to stop inflation, you do not accommodate to it. And with monetary policy and fiscal policy. And it's all very well to talk about incomes policy and all the other good phrases, but you've got to confront it frontally. And policy began to be oriented much more that way.
In the mid-1970s, you also began to write a regular column for the Wall Street Journal. And I think you were among several people who, over a period of 10 years then, I think, comprised a faculty. I remember Milton Friedman saying one could get the best economics education available in America simply by reading the Wall Street Journal economics articles on the editorial page on a regular basis. And you would publish an essay every month, every 2 months, on a regular basis. How did you get appointed to that faculty?
In Ann Arbor, the phone rang one day, and it was somebody from the Wall Street Journal. It was someone I had gotten acquainted with in Washington. But he wanted to know if I'd be interested, and I thought it might be fun. Turned out to be a little more work than I had realized. They were a very good publication because, unlike some, they'd be very careful if it were a little too long. You know, some publications will just whack off the final 2 inches and leave the reader suspended in the air. They never would do that. They would suggest, now this is what we would suggest. And it's read. So if you had an article, you would probably hear from some people.
I remember an article that you wrote during the energy crisis and various legislation during the time when we had long gasoline lines in the United States. Do you remember the one I'm talking about?
I do. And there was another illustration of just adhering to the basic logic of the market system leads you to the right conclusion as to what to do. We were controlling prices, the Europeans were not. Not surprisingly, Europe got the oil. And I remember the finance minister, I think, of Germany, was asked by a reporter, are we going to have gasoline lines the way they have in the U.S.? And I remember the article said, the minister laughed and said, no, we recognize that if we want the gasoline, we have to pay for it. That's all there was to it.
Now, there was legislation that was gaining popularity in the Congress to have a national coupon system, I believe.
That was a case where I may have cooled Congress off a bit, because they were talking about coupon rationing, drawing on the experience of the war, of course. And everybody would get X gallons, and then, but you'd have to give up coupons. Well, I wrote an article, the thrust of which is very simple, that if we adopt this system, very quickly, people will figure out the cost of a gallon of gasoline is whatever the controlled price was, plus the cost of getting a coupon in order to qualify, because there will be a well-organized market for coupons. And it might finally occur to the Congress, why not just let the price establish equilibrium in the market and get rid of all this nonsense?
Get the coupons.
And I had a call, I think the next day, from a congressman. He said, you know, we were going to have hearings on this, and members of the committee read the article and decided we don't want any of that.
Of the various areas of economic policy in this same period from the 50s through the present, where do you think there's been the most progress? As an outsider, I think I would say monetary policy. We seem to have learned the most.
I would agree. I'd put monetary policy number one. At the time I was leaving Harvard, we economists, really attached very little significance. We were a little double-minded. We didn't want tight monetary policy. That might slow down the expansion. On the other hand, we weren't very much interested in easier monetary policy, and here we were inconsistent because it wouldn't do any good. Well, now I think we've got that straight.
It seems that, at least from today's perspective, monetary policy has been progressive. It seems to be getting better. We seem to have been learning. And we would have to say that policy is much better than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago, and we think we know why. It's not clear to me that we've had similar progress in such things as government taxing and spending. There, it almost seems to be a pendulum. We get it right for a period of time, but then we go back to more complications. I'm wondering if you agree with that, or why it would be that we've done well in one area of economic policy, but not in another.
I think there are two or three sets of reasons. One of them is that inevitably, to jigger fiscal policy one way or the other requires congressional action. And while we can talk about giving maybe the president authority to move rates up and down a bit, I don't detect any real interest in that. Second reason is that these thorny, sticky questions of, well, social fairness, for example, the distribution according to income of the effects of monetary policy changes. I can't see a congressman making a speech in the Congress and being able to answer very many questions on what he means. It just can't be done.
You've spent a lot of time studying Japan, thinking about it. I know you've traveled there and lived there on occasion. Much of what you say about Japan and American policy suggests to me, lurking in the background of a lot of your thought, is that the government thinks it has control over things, and it acts as if it does. But there's much that goes on in a society that the government can have no very good information about or ability to control. So you can do the right thing, and things come out badly. You can do the wrong thing, things come out well, and nobody's ever quite sure why.
And I'm sure there are people in Japan who would say, right on. It's the way it is.
Do you think that the growth of the statistical system has given people in the government much truer information so that they can do things with greater confidence?
I think so.
Is this problem I mentioned before, is it a measurement problem or is it a political problem?
Well, it's several parts political and one part measurement. But it is partly measurement. It'd be hard to make the case that we're worse off because we have more information. We want good information, but we found ourselves in the early stages of fighting a war, a world war, and the administration didn't know how big the economy was. Should we plan for defense spending to be $100 billion, $200 billion? Well, how big an economy do we have? Nobody knew. And as it happened, within just a matter of weeks after I landed in the Department of Commerce, the National Income Division came out with their estimates of GNP, Gross National Product, from 29 to 40. And we've been carrying on ever since. I think we're better off for having it. There are those who would say the less information government has, the better. I do not share that view because in the final analysis, I don't think lack of information is going to impede anyone.
You've said that in this nation, it is the optimists who have usually turned out to be the realists. Would you tell me what reflections led to that?
Well,
I think of you as a realist, a person who is a careful student of economics, but is not confined to theory. You care about the evidence as it is. You try to be practical and try to do the best possible thing in the current circumstances. And sometimes circumstances don't lead one to be optimistic, and yet that seems to be your broadest view.
I wouldn't want to sign my name to the view that all is the best in the best of all possible worlds, always. We certainly, and anyone growing up in the Great Depression doesn't have to have that spelled out. But not infrequently we get worried and we think of this gargantuan problem that is looming up going to pose massive problems for the country. And yet, if you think back historically, in most cases, we came out of that, each one, pretty well. Even with the Great Depression, we didn't do very well. We didn't, at that time, understand what was going on. But, and it could be said, we came out of it pretty well, partly because of the war. But we would have come out of it anyway. And we came out of the Great Depression. We have been through some recessions since, and we came out of them. I do think we face now, in the re-patterning of the international economic scene, we do face some severe challenges to our capability to manage political and economic policy. But I'll stay with it. I'd be optimistic that we'll find our way through that tunnel. I probably won't be here. You will.
Paul, I've enjoyed talking with you very much. Thank you so much.
You were a good interrogator. You must be a lawyer.
Ha ha ha.